that should be put on the audit. Safe to say that we have then accepted the over from Ngubane Incorporated. Chair, with that, it's also important to highlight that as we give you the briefing today, the audit of ASNESCO was somewhat delayed, and today we will then be presenting the audit outcome for the 2021 financial year. The delay in the audit outcomes is primarily because of the delay in the submission of the financial statements. And currently, as I've indicated, we've taken over the audit, and we're currently busy with the 21-22 audit for ASNESCO, of which we will then brief the committee once that audit is concluded. With that, Chair, I'm going to then allow Nomthandazo to present the audit outcomes for 2021, supported by Chitito. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members, and all the colleagues who are on the call with us today. As indicated by Madi, my name is Nomthandazo Ndlovu from the HSA, and I will be taking you through the audit outcomes for ASNESCO for 2021. And as Madi had already indicated, that the 2021 audit was signed off quite late last year, and the biggest reason for the late signing of the 2021 was because of the delayed submission of the EFS. And also, as already indicated by Madi, that HSA was not auditing ASNESCO. However, it was a Section 4-3 audit, which was then outsourced to Ngubane. So the overall message on the audit outcome for 2021 was that ASNESCO received a qualified audit opinion for 2021. This was, however, an improvement, Chair, from the two previous audit opinions, which were a disclaimer. And the improvement in the audit outcome, really, Chair, would be mainly attributable to management having implemented some of the recommendations that were made in the prior audits, however, not all of them. I think what we see is that from the 2021 qualified financial statements, there were still some areas of concern that contained material misstatements. There were material misstatements in a number of areas, such as the environmental rehabilitation, liability, inventories, trade and other payables, taxation, net cash flow from operating and financing activities. And also when you look, Chair, at the opening balances of the property, plant and equipment and intangible assets, there were material misstatements there. Hence the overall qualification, which is slightly better from the disclaimer from the previous 2 years. I think to note, Chair, in terms of what was noted by the auditors for the audit, was that was inadequate oversight by the governance structures in the preparation and the review of the financial statements. As I'm sure you would all be aware, that the entity did not have a fully constituted board as required by the Companies Act. And also the CEO was acting as the board, and the audit was acting as the board chair as well. So there was that conflicting interest, and also the entity did not have an audit committee. However, all that has subsequently been rectified going into the 21-22 year. Also to note, Chair, was the high staff turnover, and this also really impacted the timely submission of the annual financial statements, and to also ensure that there were proper controls in terms of financial reporting. This was indicated by also the fact that we received multiple financial statements. I think there were 7 iterations to the financial statements, which also then just had an impact in terms of concluding the audit on time. What we really would like to maybe just put to management and also to the board is to encourage them to put an audit plan action that will ensure that we address the root causes, especially, Chair, in terms of the repeat material misstatements and the annual financial statements. So as much as we will be starting the 21-22 financial the audit, we're hoping that some of the root causes that would have emanated from the 2021 audit would have then been addressed as we carry on with the 21-22 audit. As I've already indicated, that also the entity does not have an internal audit function, and I think it would be quite critical, Chair, if the entity could look into establishing an internal control function so that at the end of the day, there could be that appropriate oversight by the structures in terms of credible financial reporting and also the financial statements that will then be submitted to the auditors for auditing. I think, Chair, taking from what you have indicated at the beginning that we do have time constraints, I would not necessarily want to go into the matters where the qualifications was noted. Safe to say that the briefing document was circulated and the matters that were qualified with the environmental rehabilitation liability, which is detailed in the briefing note, also the private error, as I've indicated, and also the opening balance of inventory as at 31st of March 2022. There were also material misstatements in terms of trade and other payables, taxation and deferred tax, and also the net cash flows from operating and financing activities. So overall, that is the audit outcomes. But also what was noted, Chair, was with regards to the compliance with legislation. The financial statements were not received on time. I think due to the reasons that I've already indicated, the instability in terms of the finance function and also just the lack of oversight from the oversight bodies in terms of making sure that credible financial statements were obtained. And also we noted that the corporate plan was not submitted. I think the exemption was provided, but not at the appropriate level. Exemption from the completion of the corporate plan should have been provided by the Minister of Finance. However, it was only obtained from the executive authority, which was then not in line as per the Treasury regulation. So when it comes to compliance matters, we did note that the corporate plan was not submitted as it was required by the regulations. And also, Chair, if you then go into, as per the briefing note that was submitted, if you go in terms of, if I can just highlight the irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we note that there was a decrease in the irregular expenditure, but when we look at the unaudited financial statements for 2022, we have noted irregular expenditure that was incurred in the current year, and this is the matter then that will just be taken forward as we conclude the audits. Same with fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Overall, in terms of the performance information, I think with us submitting or provide the audit outcomes on the 2021 financial statements, I think the impact of COVID was still very much felt during those particular years, with the result that most of the targets that were set were not achieved by the entity. Also in terms of the financial performance, you will see that there was a slight decline in terms of the revenue that was reported by the entity in 2021 compared to 2022. Also, just going back to the impact of COVID-19 at the time. So, Chair, you would note that most of this information, because we're sitting in 2023, it is somehow outdated because we're only presenting the 2021 financial audit outcomes rather, and not necessarily the 21-22 audit outcomes, which are still subject to the audit. So really, Chair, in terms of the recommendations, we've also highlighted those in terms of the briefing notes. Really, the first one being the strengthening of the internal control environment, which will then ensure that the credible and reliable financial statements that also do comply with legislation are prepared. And we also recommend, Chair, that an internal audit function be set up at the entity that will also just assist with the oversight function. And also in terms of the material weaknesses that have been noted from the previous audits, we would encourage the entity to develop and implement an audit action plan that would focus on addressing those root causes that we have highlighted. And also, if there could just be a bit of stability, Chair, in terms of the finance function, I think it would really assist in taking the entity forward, and also just making sure that the audit committee is also strengthened in terms of the reviewing of the annual financial statements and the performance information. So overall, Chair, we have noted an improvement, but I think the entity can still strengthen the oversight and strengthen the credibility of the financial statements to move out of a qualified audit opinion and move into a more unqualified audit opinion, which I think all the entities are striving towards. I think I'll just pause there, and maybe through you, Chair, if I can ask Chitizwa if there's anything that she would like to add, or if there are any questions, I would be happy to fill those. I tried to go really in high level detail, as we had indicated, Chair. So if I can just pause there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. I think, colleagues, let's get any additions from the audit team side, and then we'll get questions.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Nomthanda. So I think you really covered everything that needs to be covered in terms of the audit for the 2021 that was done. I think just to highlight the fact that most of the issues that were raised were actually coming from the RMC JV, which is an unincorporated entity which does not really comply with the PFMA. So there is a bit of control issues in terms of the JV. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. All right, so how far, when do we anticipate bringing the audit up to date?
If I can just...
Yeah, come in.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair. So we have already started with the planning of the audit, and we are working quite hard to try to finalize it within the next couple of months, then we'll be able to report back to yourselves, Chair. But the audit has already started, and being March, April, we're looking to say finalize mid-May before the submission of the 2023 financial statements. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Yeah, because we've had issue with the ALISCO before, you see, and they've appeared on this issue of non-submission and late submission. All right. Colleagues, any questions? All right. I think let's do this then, colleagues, on ALISCO, because I thought we'd start with that, and it was pretty straightforward. Say that we will await the conclusion of the audit process underway, and then conduct the hearings into ALISCO on both the basis of this audit and the upcoming audit, so that if there's any change, then we are in a position to be able to cover ground on both fronts, because we may end up having a hearing in a vacuum to find that there will be changes. I'm not preempting the audit, but I just think it will be a better use of our time on that front. All right, thank you very much, AG, on ALISCO. We will await that audit. We note this submission now insofar as where things are at. All right. Danelle?
Thank you, Kim. This is Mike again, also leading the team that is on the Danelle side. Chair, on Danelle, Mulani Rabonda is going to be presenting for us. And again, here, Chair, we're sitting with an audit team that has the 2021 and 2022 financial statements that are outstanding. And primarily the reason for that is that if you look at the 2021 financial year,
financial statements were only submitted only 18 months after the year end, and with regards to 2022, the financial statements were only submitted 8 months after the financial year. In actual fact, for 2021, we actually received the financial statements in November last year, and then for 2022, we only received the financial statements in January this year. Part of the reasons for the delay in the submission of the financial statements was mainly as a result of the continued operational and insolvency challenges that DINEL was experiencing, and we did see that had resulted in quite an exodus of skills, thereby impacting the ability of the entity to prepare financial statements. So for today, Chair, we're just going to go through at a high level the previous audit outcomes. I do believe that we have presented those to the committee, but we thought that it is important to just touch base on that. And also safe to say that we are working with DINEL in terms of ensuring that the audit of the audits of the two outstanding financial years also gets up to speed, and we finalize those as soon as possible. Chair, with that, I'll hand over to Fumalani to take us through the presentation. Thanks, Chair.
All right, thank you. Perfect. Let's get the presentation up. All right. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Committee. As my disembodied has indicated, I am Fumalani Rabonda, and I will be taking you through just the presentation in general. Madizimala has already articulated on the opening kind of the overall message that we wanted to share with the committee. We will not, however, go through the audit outcome because we are of the view that those audit outcomes are not recent, because the available audit outcome are for the year ended 2021 March 2020, and that's like more than 2 years ago, and we are of the view that we'll talk about a matter that are most recent. So around the financial statements that are outstanding, the audit that are outstanding, it will be for the financial year ended 31 March 2021 and 31 March 2022, which we now have the financial statements with us, and then the audit is about to commence. The plan is that we must have this already completed and issued both of them by end of July this year. However, that can be affected a little bit with the plan from the entity that they are planning to also submit the 2023 financial statements in May this year, and have requested that if possible, let us then report on all three financial statements financial year at the same time, which that can then just add a month to our term length, and we can finish by around August this year. We do encourage the board that they need to implement measures to ensure that they return back to normality in terms of the term length of submitting financial statements having been late this late. That is why they have committed that for the 22-23 financial year, they are going to submit by end of May this year. It's important to also note, if we're talking about a state-owned entity, issues of funding in state-owned entities are very important. Hence, we thought we need to also cover around the issue of funding, noting that DINEL initially had about 3.3 billion rand worth of guaranteed debt by government, of which that has now been settled, and they are only left with 100 million rand, which is maturing by 23 September this year. So far, in terms of the liquidity of the entity, they do not have long-term debt anymore other than the current debt, which has been outstanding for previous years from the operational reasons. Also to note that the entity is not in a position to raise more funding, specifically around using bonds, because their trading has been suspended from the JSE as a result of them failing to submit financial statements on time. The JSE listed requirements, and also the Companies Act, they are specific that a state-owned entity must submit financial statements audited within 7 months after the end of that particular financial year, with denial they had failed to do so, and JSE had then suspended the trading of their bonds. Furthermore, even the CIPC, the Companies and the Intellectual Property Commission, had issued denial with compliance notice for failing to submit audited financial statements. So basically, they have tabled annual reports, that annual returns, I mean to say, that were not accompanied by audited financial statements, which is in contravention of the Companies Act. We have noted with the recent medium-term budget policy statement of last year that the Minister of Finance has allocated further funding to DNEL, which DNEL is going to utilize that funding to implement their turnaround strategy. So that will be about payment of outstanding liabilities, current liabilities to the creditors and employees, and also for funding of the strategy moving forward. We are hoping that the board would then be able to implement a plan that is aligned to the funding, basically that the money that they have been allocated, they're able to spend it in line with the key milestones or key activities that inform their turnaround plan, so that there will be then be alignment between what they got the money for and what they used it eventually for, and the entity can return to normality. Having said that, we have noted that government has over the time acknowledged the challenges that are faced by state-owned entities, and they have committed to implement a number of measures and reforms to strengthen the governance of state-owned entities. Some of those reforms involve the Shareholder Management Act that they want to pass. The funding criteria on how is government going to fund the developmental mandate of SOEs. Those are good measures, but we are concerned that the pace of finalizing those reforms is very slow. As you speak right now, there is no funding criteria for state-owned entities, noting that some of the state-owned entities, they do have a developmental mandate, which then government needs to be upfront in terms of how are they going to fund that going forward. Entities such as DNEL get affected by that because an ad hoc bailout or ad hoc allocation of funding from National Treasury, they do not provide that policy certainty or clarity that the investors and the market needs from such entities. Because as a commercial entity, DNEL needs that policy certainty so that the banks and other funders are able to be sure in terms of what is government's plans around this entity and how are they going to fund the entity going forward. So we're therefore encouraging government that they need to, once they have acknowledged or have determined that they want to take these measures, implement these measures, they need to fast track the implementation of such measures, specifically the funding criteria. As we have noted that DNEL has submitted the financial statement for the two outstanding financial years, we are still encouraging the board to implement measures, not only to submit the financial statements on time, but to also address the underlying root causes that have caused the poor quality of financial statements in the past. As we have noted, when we're engaging with management in terms of the AFS that they have submitted now, they've indicated that they still have to undergo a process of rectifying all the underlying misstatements. So we're actually anticipating that the financial statement, the audit come will not necessarily improve that much on what they've submitted so far. Hence, we are encouraging them to put measures in place to improve the quality going forward. And we are also indicating that the board, together with the shareholder representatives in DPE, they should ensure that the measures that have been planned for the turnaround plan of the entity, they are implemented and timeously monitored to avoid a collapse of the entity. So getting the money from treasury is not enough. They need to be clear outlining of this plan, what are the activities that inform the turnaround plan, and can we monitor those on an ongoing basis and be able to provide oversight on them to avoid the entity going back to the challenges that it has experienced in the past. Chair, the audit that come for the previous years, which is the year ended 31 March 2020, will not go into detail, noting that they are kind of do not represent the current state of the entity basically. because they are 2 years old. So I will provide them in the briefing document for information, but just have to say that it was a disclaimer for the past 3 financial years. Let me pause here, Chair. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Can you just push that slide up? This one. No, no, no. I wanted that graphic on. There we go. All right. I want to put that clarity out there. All right. Can we get comments, colleagues?
May, and they requested that if possible, they want us to incorporate on the ongoing audit and report at the same time. If that is the case and that gets adopted, with practical, it may just only move the audit timelines by a month, and then we will report by August. But we'll be pushing for our July timeline for the two audits, for the two that they were submitted.
There's a fundamental risk here in negotiated processes, or rather negotiating processes in an established statutory process. I'm not sure if I'm making sense. In the sense that auditing must not be at the pleasure and comfort of the auditee, wherein it's their terms that you know take precedence. And of course, this if that's the case, it must be about then them not cooperating, particularly in the SOE space. You know, in Hamlet, there's a very apt line: something is rotten in the state of Denmark. And I think here I can say that something is rotten in the state of SOEs. And I hope the AD doesn't fall into the trap of this being normalized. That's why colleagues at some point, one was of the view that the PFMA in itself, in allowing for delays in submission, there has to be tighter regulations around what constitutes, what can be delayed, or how a delay can be endorsed. It can't just be open-ended with the one-page letter which says absolutely nothing and then there's a delay. All right. Madi?
No, thank you, Jan. And I think in your comments just now, you've covered me. Because I wanted to indicate to yourself, Honorable Chair, and to the honorable members, that as AGSA, we're equally concerned because the delay in the submission of the financial statements not only impacts the areas that Timo and Nomthandazo we're talking to, but it also impacts very heavily on accountability and oversight, because to the extent that these entities are not able to present the financial statement for audit, it impacts our ability to conduct those audits, but equally it impacts those charged with governance as well as those charged with the oversight responsibility in terms of ensuring that the necessary oversight is exercised over the entities that we're talking to today. So I think it's something that we would also encourage the committee to engage with the relevant accounting authorities in order to ensure that ultimately those financial statements that are delayed, not only are they submitted, but the quality thereof is such that it will add value to the oversight processes. So I just felt that it's important that we re-emphasize the point that you're raising, and also the impact that we see in terms of the delays in the submission, especially as it relates to accountability and oversight. Thanks, Jeff.
No, we definitely will prioritize that. I think there's a need for a very frank discussion between us and DPE and the boards of these entities, particularly Denel. And I was deliberate in asking for this light to remain up because it tells you exactly the problem. And for so long as it remains in this way, we have a problem. All right, colleagues, are there any, can this slide be taken down? And then we'll go to Sasa. Sasa. Land Bank, stand by. Oh, no, DMEE and then Land Bank.
Good
morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members and everyone else in attendance. My name is Lovens van Vieren. I'm the business unit leader responsible for the audit of SASSA. SASSA is the agency that pays the social grants on behalf of the Department of Social Development. Mr. Faisal Jayogi will take us through the presentation and Chair, as always, will be taking questions after that. Thank you.
All right, fantastic. Thanks, Lawrence.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. As Lawrence indicated, I will be taking through the committee through the audit outcomes of SASSA. I'm just going to make this into a more readable mode, and then I'll go through there. Chair, I'm not going to go through too much. I'm going to concentrate on the more on a more critical outcomes of SASSA and what the issues are in terms of the time that's related. We have provided the full briefing document, which the members, the honorable members, can have a look at it. With regards to the ecosystem, I think, this is quite an important slide in the importance of the accountability ecosystem and the relationships that need to be built between the state, the citizen, as well as to answer for the state, for them to answer for their shortcomings in this regard. And it's important how we work, as well as the AGSA involved in this whole process. So the move would be with the outcome of having providing valuable information to the citizens of this country, and those that need to be held accountable are being held accountable. So each role that's being played in that particular regard. Chair, the audit outcomes, I'm not going to go to detail. It's quite important to stuff of the various audit outcomes in this, and the most important was is to try to achieve your unqualified audit opinion with no findings. That's your clean audit opinion, where everything is working as intended, the money is spending as intended, and the necessary service delivery is being provided.
We are quite okay with this one. Let's move thanks, to Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, with regards to SASSA, as you can see from the 2018-19 financial year, they have been steady in their audit outcomes with the unqualified audit opinion on its financial statements, but they had findings. The findings were either in relation to the compliance with legislation or with regards to the performance information. So it's been quite steady. For the 2021-22, yes, the financial statements were fairly presented, but we did have findings on compliance with legislation, specifically around the fact that they continue to incur irregular expenditure surrounding the leases, the contracts, the lease contracts that has been extended, which they were not initially went out in proper tender way, not properly cancelled. So those leases were still a big problem, and therefore we still qualified them. So they're accounting authority did not take appropriate steps to prevent that irregular expenditure from reoccurring. The other issue is on performance information, where for one of the indicators on the customer care, the evidence they provided could not talk to the amount as been reported in the performance report, and therefore we had a finding in that, and therefore they did not receive a clean audit outcome, but they had unqualified on his financial statements, but with findings on performance information as well as the compliance with legislation. Chair, with regards to the financial health, overall we're quite happy that SASSA got a good financial health. It's a good financial, it's a green, the stuff there, we had no issues, but there is a couple of issues that we picked up with debt collection is normally greater than 100 debt. Mostly this debt relates to staff debtors, so it's something that they need to improve to collect those staff debtors. There's been a lot of them with bursaries and it, so they need to make sure that they could. Other than that, all the other indicators that we looked at, we were quite happy. We also just indicated that they, for the current year, it was 1.6 million rand of fruitless and wasteful expenditure that was created. And overall, the creditors' payment period is within the 30 days. So we're happy with their overall financial health. Yeah, I've indicated the compliance issue that we've reported in the audit report. It was on the prevention of irregular expenditure, where majority of them related to the leases expenditure that are still being used and did not go out the proper tender processes in this regard. So then we've given some detailed indication with regards to the irregular expenditure analysis. This is the irregular expenditure that was incurred in the current financial year. You can look at it, 65 million. There has been a decrease from 2018-19 on the irregular expenditure incurred per year. So you can see there's a quite a tremendous decrease from 147 in 2018 to 55 million in 2021-22. The main reason for the 55 million, as I indicated, the majority of that related to the leases. I think it was about close to 40 million related to leases, and the others are other non-compliance with regards to not going out on proper tender contract with regards to the cleaning and sanitation, failure to comply with local production, as well as other issues on CIBD, the winning provider not providing tax methods. So those were the issues, and that makes up the 54 million, the 55 million that was incurred in the current financial year. Of the 55 million, 99% of that relates to a breach of the five pillars of the procurement in terms of the constitution, and majority of them related to the equity and fairness and the competitiveness around that, surrounding the leases in that regard. We had a small amount of 1,600 where they did not receive the goods that were the sub there, so that was a small portion, and then the others were not approved by the relegated delegated officials, and that about just 176,000 that were the sub. Honourable Chair members, we also looked at how was the irregular expenditure dealt with in the current financial year by management. So we started off with the 2020-21 balance of the 1.14 billion to see how SASSA has dealt with it. From that 1.14 billion, we take notice that 18% of that was condoned through National Treasury. That's about 202 million. And 82%, that's the balance of the closing balance of the irregular expenditure and was still not yet dealt with. And we then further look into this to what's the reason for the irregular expenditure not being dealt with. And the majority of that is 88.82 was the delays in completing investigations into the irregular expenditures. The cases that were delayed are still investigated, and we've got details on that. There's some that were submitted for condonement to National Treasury, around 53 million, so they're still waiting for the condonement. Majority of cases was submitted to the in-house labor and legal for further action to be taken, looking at about 799 million, as well as furthermore for consideration to be condoned and then submitted to National Treasury, about 29.2 million. The other issues are quite small. They still need to finalize the deal termination of about 23.7 million of the 994 million, as well as still waiting a consequence management outcome. Then we look at details as well. Of the 994 million, there are about four big cases of 730 million that relates to the 994 million. Of that, 281 million relates to a contract that was given out in September 2018 that did not follow the normal tender process in terms of the mandatory requirements for issuing that contract, as well as the incorrect calculating of the scoring in terms of the PPR, and that's about 281 million red. This case is still in progress as it's in the process of being filed after the public report on this matter in that regard. Then we have another big one of 419 million relates to various security services that have been provided by various security companies in 2012 for the buildings of SASSA at head office as well as the region. They did not follow their proper tender requirements in 2012, and this has resulted in irregular expenditure. National Treasury confirmed the irregular expenditure, and this is one of the ones that's currently sitting with National Treasury for condonement. and they're still waiting for the condonement there or before they can write off that particular one. Then we have another one for 18 million. It's got to do with the ICT contract. It was initially declared as irregular expenditure for not following proper process, but with subsequent meetings that SASA had with the National Federation of Guard, it was confirmed that this is not irregular and they will then follow the process to remove it from the irregular expenditure register. And then the last one is on the 12 million contract. It's a communication contract that was issued. Palomula did not follow the appropriate tender requirements. And the case will be final once the corrective discipline process has been completed, which is still in progress. Just to note that of the 994 million, 652 million currently is sitting with National Treasury for condonement. This includes the 419 million that I indicated for the physical priority and the various smaller ones, with a small amount that forms part of the 362 pieces, which they're waiting from National Treasury for the condonement and then the write-off in regards to these financial statements. On the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, Honourable Chair and Members, you can see there has been an increase in 2019-20, and then it has been subsequently decreased quite tremendously. The 320 million increase from that year was specifically around the 316 million, which I'll touch base when I talk on the MI. It's got to do with the payment to a previous service provider, CPS, which was determined initially as irregular expenditure. Then in 2019-20, it was then moved to fruitless and wasteful expenditure because there was no benefit received. At the same time, it was also removed from the fruitless and wasteful expenditure to a debtor because the court has pronounced that 316 million should be recovered from that supplier. So therefore, it was removed, and therefore from 2021, you can see the big reduction because that amount is now included in the debtor's amount and was subsequently impaired in the debtor's amount because the recoverability of that is very slim in that particular regard. For the current financial year, it was 1.6 million. The majority of that 1.6 million relates to a previous year case that was initially transferred of 1.4 million for a Makonza event that was previously transferred to debtors out of, but after re-looking at it, it should have been remained in fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So therefore, it was transferred back to fruitless and wasteful expenditure in the current year. So that's the biggest portion of it, the 1.4 million of the 1.6. The other amounts are quite small. It's got to do with interest and penalties, hotels, where there was no shows, where you booked and the people did not the stuff there, and then not falling proper, not getting proper the stuff there on the first and after the assessment. So those were the key issues with regards to the 1.6 million. We also included the closing balance of the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. As you can see, the closing balance is about quite steady in this regard. Of the 88 million closing balance, you're looking at about 84 million relates to five cases that we've highlighted there. The big one is the 74.8 million that was paid to the previous service provider, CPS. This was for work that they billed SASA, and yet they did not perform the work. SASA, before when the transition period was to move over the grant payments to SAPO, SASA initially tested the process where they made payments directly into beneficiary bank accounts. So SASA made those payments, but what the CPS did, as part of their agreement, they were entitled to, although they may not have made payments, and therefore billed SASA the amount of 74.8 million, which SASA then paid. And this was, we felt that there was no services being provided in that particular regard, and they should not have made that payment in that regard, and therefore 74.8 million is regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The other one's share is there's about 4.1 million that was issued to a supplier that's scored the second highest when you did the calculation, and therefore they should not have been given that amount. And therefore, the difference is then regarded as a fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Amount of 3.5 million was incurred in 2013. This related to the VIP protection services for previous minister at the department, and they did not follow this, so there were no proper procedures being followed in this, and therefore the whole stuff was regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure in that particular regard. And also there was a postponement of the Makonza event, but it was amount of 1.4 million paid, and this amount is also included in regard as there was no benefit being received in that particular regard. Legal is currently looking into the matter. I think the others are quite small, so it's not a sub there. They're looking at 3.2 million out of the 88 million that's still in a determination phase to be finalized. And I'm going to then touch on the material irregularities. We issued three material irregularities for SASSA in the current financial year. The material irregularities, the first one is what I've previously indicated, that's currently sitting within the 74 million in the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. This was where SASSA did not, where SASSA made a payment, and the supplier CPS at that time still billed SASSA for the work that was not done, and they did not make payment, and therefore they were not entitled to that amount, and therefore the 74 million. We then issued a MI in this particular regard because of the financial loss that was incurred in this regard. The accounting authority has responded to us on this MI that we have issued, and one of the keys to the stuff is that they have done this, they've sent it out to National Treasury for a full-on investigation. The investigation was completed in November 2022. The main purpose of the investigation was to determine if any actions can be taken against any previous employees, any current employees that were involved in this process. What the investigation report is that they need to continue to get legal advice in terms of those if actions can be taken in terms they have found that it, yes, it was, there is a financial loss, but they need to get whether they can take action against the former employees and the current employees taking the prescription period and other issues involved in that particular report. What SASSA has indicated, they currently appointed a firm, a legal firm, to look into the matter, and they intend having this process done by the end of April 2023 to see if further action and recoverability can be taken against any previous employee and any current employee that has been identified to have non-complied in this particular regard and authorized that payment. With regards to the other MI we issued is the 316 million. I've also highlighted this. This was previously now fruitless and wasteful. Also payment made to CPS in June 2014, where CPS were doing a whole of re-registering all grant beneficiaries. They then indicated that in that particular regard that the children was not included as part of the contract, and they then billed SASSA an additional amount of 316 million in variation of the agreement. This matter was, however, taken to the High Court and even up to the Constitutional Court, which was basically where the Constitutional Court agreed to the High Court that the CPS should not have been paid that amount of 316 million because it was part of the contract. And as a result, they were supposed to pay back that amount of 316 million plus interest back to SASSA. Taking that into account with the 74 million, CPS applied or there was an application for liquidation. The liquidation process of CPS is still currently ongoing, so that is still going to take. So the chances of recoverability is very slim on the 74 and 316 million. We then issued a MI in this regard because to determine there is a financial loss that's indicated and to determine if anybody should be liable and further action should be taken against any former employees in this particular regard. Similar to the 74 million, the accounting authority appointed a firm through National Treasury who found the firm to do the forensic investigation. The forensic investigation was completed in November 2022 and issued a report in that regard. Part of the report, they further indicated that they get a legal opinion, and SASSA's own legal opinion provided opinion with regard that no further action be taken on to the previous accounting authority and grant administration members that were involved in this particular payment due to the prescription and the timelessness. We have received this from SASA, their response. We just busy currently looking into this and just getting legal to see if, based on what legal has said, is it correct or should they still have taken further action in this particular. So we're looking into that matter in terms of a legal aspect to see if the Prescription Act does really apply and can you not do anything further. There were no current employees that are currently should be liable. These were all previous employees that no longer work in the organization for the 316 million. Here, then we issued the third MI on the payment of the SRT 350 grant that came into effect during the COVID-19. The big issues here is that when we does validations against other databases before they make payments, we also then got information against other databases. And we also picked up that there were still payments that were made to ineligible applicants. One of the reasons is that SASA uses databases available to them. It's normally about 2 months prior to what they, of that particular month. So to give an example, if they could make the October payment, they're using the July, August database that's available to them that's been made available to the various stuff, and therefore they cannot pick up. We also look at the databases they use as well as get, we obtain our own databases just to make sure, and we still pick up that there was payment being made to ineligible applicants. We then raised the MI in this particular regard. The accounting authority has responded to us, where they partly agreed and they disagreed with us in certain issues, and that they work on what data is available to them at that particular time. We then looked at the stuff, then we still feel that there is more that they can be done in this particular regard, and in order to ensure that they can recover most of their money back from the stuff. Therefore, in the audit report, we then issued a recommendation to the accounting authority to implement within 6 months. Some of the recommendations was to improve the controls to prevent and detect all those payments to ineligible beneficiaries. And this should look at different verifying methods in terms of the available databases, as well as ensuring necessary evidence of how they went about, as well as doing the means testing with the bank to just to pick up as much as possible on those ineligible beneficiaries being paid. The other issue that we also provided to them was that action should be taken to recover payments that were made to ineligible, especially those that were working for the state at the time of applying for a grant. We picked up quite a number of those that were working for the state, and they should then start the process of recovering this. It's quite a tedious process because they cannot recover that. They have to contact each of the different departments, provincial departments, identify. They have to then do consequence management for those, so it's quite a tedious process in that, but they want to say that they need to follow up and make sure that they can recover as much of those amounts that were paid to those government employees. And the other one was to obtain a legal advice on whether they can recover the money paid to those that were not employed by the state, and based on the feasibility and the cost effectiveness of recovering those money, on whether it will be feasible and cost effective, and take into account that most of those amounts that were paid is 350, some only paid for 3 months, so you're only looking at 1,050. And the accounting authority after that has provided us a response on the 30th of January. We're still in the process of looking at recommendations or response in this particular regard, especially on the one with regards to the feasibility and cost effectiveness, which they identified is not feasible in cost effectiveness because just the process of issuing summonses and it could be costing much more than this particular regard. And they've also indicated that what they will do going forward is try to recover. If a person does qualify at a later date, they will recover from any future payments. So just to look at the legality on there. And then the other issue is that we're looking on is to see if, based on what they said, if adequate work has been taken to recover from those that are working for the state, and if there is anything more they can do, and the follow-up that they should be doing on their side, although they have communicated with the various departments, what should they be doing furthermore to try to recover any undue payments that were made to those working for the state. So we're busy looking into that, and we will then provide them with our recommendations in that particular regard. Chair, overall from the observations, I think with the MIs, it has made a difference. Is that once we raise the MI, there must further investigations taken to determine whether anybody can be held liable. So we do see some benefit in that, in those MIs as well for the 74 and the 316 million. I think with the amount of those there, because of the liquidation process is ongoing, this will continue, but it's uncertain how much of that money will be recovered. That's outstanding in the from the liquidation progress. Also with the 350 grants, I think what we have made it that SASSA has put in further action with the bank validations. They've managed to cut down on the number that we previously identified as ineligible applicants. So that has reduced once bank verifications has been done, the means testing with the bank verifications, which may disturb, as well as they managed to stop some payments and recover about 56 million. From ineligible beneficiaries, those who were not applied by the state, where they were previously then, after that they were found to be qualified and they managed to make those stop payments and recover the amounts they are. From those that were employed by the state, as of 15 January 2023, they received about 1.176 million back from those that employed by the state, which about 1,450 employees, but they should all step up for that effort to see what they can recover much more in that regard. Chair, we've indicated some recommendations for the committee that the accounting authority should implement, the committee should get a progress report from the accounting authority on these recommendations, on the investigations that were done, and how it has impacted all the implicated officials, and is there any chance of recovery of the loss where appropriate, as well as request the accounting authority to indicate how these recommendations on the 350 grants were implemented to ensure that all losses are prevented and that proper recoveries are being taken place where there were payments made to these ineligible applicants. Chair, on the audit process and justice, I have indicated that the finding was on one of the indicators on the percentage of new grant applications that the evidence provided did not talk to the amount that was reported in the annual performance report, and therefore we reported that in the audit report. Overall, we had a 29 out of 40 achievement of the targets for Program 2. That was the subject. And just to take note, as Lawrence indicated in the beginning of the meeting, that SASSA administers the grants on behalf of DSD. The amounts of the grant payments is included in the DSD financial statements, but the performance information with regards to the service delivery, the applications that the consumer has, the turnaround of the resolving queries, all sits in SASSA's financial performance information. So therefore, this relates to the SASSA service. And so anything that's not been the subject impacts on the service delivery, on the social assistance, and the timely being ensured that payments are being made timely to the grant applicants. Here in the audit report, we also reported on some investigations that currently took place during the year. Some of that relates to the social relief or distress grant payments. That is not necessarily 350, but also any other social relief distress that happened between 2017 and 18 with regards to blankets or distribution of food parcels or any of those there, where there was an investigation that's been happening. The proceedings were still in place at the date of this report, and SASSA is still in the process of implementing recommendations and disciplinary hearings against those implicated officials in that particular. The SASSA's fraud and compliance also did various investigations with regards to the non-compliance relating to the grant, as well as procurement and contract management. 37 cases in the current financial year were submitted to SEPS. SEPS is still in the process of investigating that particular one. And then the last one is one during the COVID-19 period with the proclamation. SIU did an investigation in regards to, in the Eastern Cape, with regards to the expenditure in relating to the COVID-19, and they found some non-compliant aid, and they've indicated that disciplinary action be taken against some officials. The investigations were concluded, but SASSA is still in a process of implementing the consequence management process, and I think this has been mainly due to, in terms of the process, the way SASSA has started with this process in, on the implicated officials and ensuring that they follow the normal HR policies in taking this process going forward in that particular regard. Chair, we just highlighted some internal control weaknesses of what led to the finding on the compliance with legislation, as well as the performance information in regards to not adequately reviewing the compliance on the irregular expenditure, the leases, as well as not keeping appropriate documentation on the performance information. Honourable Chair, we then just included some root causes of these findings, as well as commitments by the accounting authority to address these findings, and I think you can see on how she will do this up to address these findings so that they can improve the audit outcome in that particular regard. We also included the commitments. We had discussions with the Honourable Minister and what she needs to do on a quarterly basis and on her follow-up and oversight role in terms of ensuring that these issues that we've highlighted is adequately dealt with, especially those issues with regards to the fraudulent payments of the grants and ensuring that where the fraudulent payments, proper actions are being taken and those preventative measures are put in place to address those weaknesses that has been identified in that particular regard. That's it on the presentation with regards to GSASA and the key issues in that particular regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. All right. Ma'am Tolashe and Ma'am Zibula are logged in via Parliament, so no colleagues, so that they can just let me know when they've got issues to raise. Colleagues, are there any questions in that regard on the SASSA matters?
Towards the end. So
department has remained stagnant over the 4 years with the department receiving a qualified audit opinion. And so we try to then highlight the areas that the department with the current audit outcomes, the first one being irregular expenditure, and this is the one area that we've been repeating on for the number of years. The department really, it seems like they are struggling with clearing the irregular expenditure, and I think the background to this is in the prior years, they had a number of contracts that they had signed but were not complying necessarily with the relevant ACM that then attracted irregular expenditure, and these some of them date back as far as 2017-18. So the department has been trying to go through all those contracts in order for them to then clear the irregular expenditure qualification. However, even in the current year, they were not yet successful in clearing it, and therefore we then raised a qualification around irregular expenditure. Another area of qualification that we raised in the current year is around the capital work in progress. So what has been happening in the department historically is they've been transferring money to different service provider for different projects, and however, when the different service provider was submitting back the invoices, they were not necessarily splitting between what relates to capital not expenditure, and because they were struggling with the splitting, unfortunately, we then raised a material misstatement around the capital work in progress. Part of this also then impacts the capital commitments that we see. In section 2.1, it's relating to the findings that I've just raised, and the recommendation we really gave to management was the fact that with regard to regular expenditure, they really need to go through all contracts and then make an analysis, because I think they are able to ring-fence most contracts that are contributing to the majority of the regular expenditure, to make an analysis and then disclose all towards this contract as a regular expenditure, and also make sure that they then improve the internal control environment to ensure that there is a prevention of any non-compliance. Because what we did see is, even though the majority of the regular expenditure comes from 2017 to 2020, there was some non-compliance that were reported even in the subsequent years, which then says the environment is not yet improved to prevent non-compliance. With the capital work in progress, we saw the fact that because some of these transactions are old and couldn't check them, what they then did is they tried to then contact the Office of the Valuator General from Treasury to assist them on how they are going to then fair value this asset. And unfortunately, at the time we were reporting in the prior year, that process was not yet completed. However, we recommended to them to say they need to improve the monthly controls and the daily reconciling, so that when the invoices are received from the service providers already at that point, they are then in the capital and the expense, so that they can clear the qualification area. I will then move to the findings relating to the audit of the annual performance report. In the prior year, we spoke in two programs, one which is chemical and waste management, which also was one of our focus areas. I'll then talk to the focus area towards the end of the presentation. And then what we really observed in this program is that there were mainly three indicators that we had problems with. The main contributing factor is the fact that they don't really have proper processes of means of verification, and therefore for some of the reported achievement they had, we either could not agree to the amounts or they could not submit financial support for them. We also know that they also did not meet some of their targets in these indicators. We also then looked at the program, it was forestry, and I think our biggest driver for us selecting this is because forestry was coming, I think, from agriculture, and then we had to then scope in this program so that we can see the progress that the department is making to integrate the program within the department and to show that it is a smooth transition. Unfortunately, there were a number of challenges that we noted in this program. In some instances, they really did not have measurement definition and processes to allow for the consistent collation and collection of information. That then resulted in findings that we are tabling today. We'll then move into the material irregularity section. So as at the time when we presented to the portfolio committee and we signed the audit report, we did not report on any material irregularities. And this was because some of the possible material irregularities were identified, were still being consulted on. Subsequent to the audit report, however, Honorable Chair and members, there were three notifications that we then issued to the accounting officer. We have provided this as a high level, so that the committee is aware, and I'm just going to give a brief summary of the circumstances around these material irregularities. Right now, we have received responses from the accounting officer, and we are still assessing those material irregularities. But the three that we've issued so far, the first one is around payments that were made on remedial work that was performed because there was realization, and this really relates to one of the landfill sites that the department had. And what the circumstances around this is the fact that the contractor started work on the project, and unfortunately there were some disagreements within the community, and then they left the project. Unfortunately, they also did not provide security in the project, and therefore there was vandalism that actually took place in the project, and therefore the department had to pay extra money to be able to correct the work before the contractor can actually continue. So currently the estimated loss is around 2.3 million. We also raised a material irregularity around payments that were made where projects were not necessarily delivered. And this is instance where, this project, the department had paid in advance a service provider or contractor for the construction. So and when the team was actually evaluating, we noted the fact that 99% of the budget was actually utilized. However, when the team went on the ground, they realized that there were two deliverables that were not yet met, and the two deliverables were of estimated value of about 8 million. So that's when we raised a material irregularity of a likely loss to the department to say they need to then follow up with the service with the supplier if they can actually get the money that we paid, or if the service provider will be able to continue with the remaining work. The last material irregularity we then notified was in instances where lease payments were made for no value of the leasing of the land. So what happened, the circumstance around this is the fact that they issued a number of contracts for the one of waste project. And what happened is for that project to be able to store the waste tire, they needed to comply with certain rezoning or zoning regulations. So what we noted when the team visited the site, they noted that there was no storing of tires on that specific plot. However, the department was making lease payments. So when the department actually, when we then investigated, was the fact that because the contractor did not disclose that they did not get the rezoning approval, they were not able to then store the tires. So from our side, we then raised a material irregularity about 4 million that the department was paying leases for a site that they were not able to utilize. I'm looking at the financial risk of the department. There were no material financial risk. However, we do know that the department underspent by about 1.6 billion. And I think the message we then left the department is that an underspending coupled with some of the targets that they didn't meet in the previous section means that this has a direct impact on the department actually discharging its mandate, and therefore it will have direct impact on the citizens. When we look at the irregular expenditure of the department, as indicated before, they had a lot of legacy contracts that they issued mainly from 2017-18, where they had a challenge with their objectivity criteria. What we then note is they seem to be a lack of understanding from the unit that was actually crafting this tenders, and then the objectivity criteria was not necessarily applied. That resulted in a majority of the contracts that they issued having this non-compliance finding. So in the current year, they disclosed 888 million relating to mainly to those contracts, which when you look at the prior year was a significant increase. And I think the biggest increase was because management is trying to resolve the irregular expenditure. They are going through certain contracts and actually they are identifying more contracts that do not qualify with this criteria. So when we look at the background breakdown of this contribution, SDM objectivity, which is the one I'm referring to, contributed about 603 million of the irregular expenditure they're disclosing. We also note the fact that with the Westbury one, they also had an objectivity criteria. However, they just disclosed separately because of the trying to ring fence within a project. So the biggest contributing factor that they have is the objective criteria that they need to work on. We also note that there were some contracts where there was poor contract management that resulted in payments of goods and services not according to the MOA, and there were some procurement that were not in line with the service level agreement, specifically with working on fire. So the accounting officer has committed to say they're going to relook at the procurement processes and improve the control environment so that this does not happen. With the fruitless and wasteful that is being reported, the department reported about 9 million of this, and the main contributing factors is really the expenditure around the implementing agencies. Ones that we raised in the MIs, where we realizing that there's some instances where they are paying for work not necessarily done, or in instances where they are then overpaying some of the depots or some of the service providers. So these we are continuously analyzing the fruitless and wasteful expenditure session. I do know that there are other MIs that are in the pipeline that we are exploring, and if they are if eventually confirmed, we will then also issue them to the accounting authority. When I look at the findings on non-compliance, they are directly linked to the presentation I've made earlier, so I won't go through them because I want to go specifically to the finding on consistency management. So because the department has really been having this significant balance of irregular expenditure over the years, they embarked on a process to then investigate the irregular expenditure balance with the aim of trying to then clear some of this. At the time of reporting as a 31 March of the backlog irregular expenditure, they had only dealt with about 53% of it, and there was a lot of the 43% was still to be investigated. But what we also noted is while they're investigating the backlog irregular expenditure, there was some non-compliance that was still taking place in the years after the previous non-compliances, where we then recommended them to while they are finalizing and investigating the previous non-compliances, they must also look at the current year non-compliance and also improve the control environment to ensure the fact that there is no non-compliance that is taking place. Because then what we saw is, as much as they were actually investigating, because there's new non-compliance taking place, the irregular expenditure balance keeps increasing. So one of the other sections that we look from a value point of view, which was also linked to the program that is scoped in, was the waste care management. And the process that we followed, we visited depots and various in the provinces. We didn't visit all of them. And the aim of us visiting these depots was to assess whether the value is being derived from payments made within the waste care management program. So what we also observed when we were looking at the first on the annual performance report was the fact that they had four targets that they had specifically set themselves to achieve or to measure against waste diverted from landfill sites. However, during the year, three of these targets were not reported on or were removed from the APP or the APR. And this was the reason provided by management was the fact that this was due to changes in the EPR regulations. Our recommendation was also the fact that even though they are updating this EPR regulations, they need to also have compensating processes to ensure that they are actually measuring the waste diverted, because that has a direct impact on any threat on environmental quality and human health. We also observed the fact that they also did not have proper processes in place to measure the number of tires that have been processed by tire processors. And as a result, the one indicator that was remaining, we then also raised a material finding around it, because we could not really confirm the amount that was then disclosed. The other observation we made, which are also linking to the material irregularity we raised earlier, was the fact that there was other control deficiencies within the waste care management, where there was inadequate contract management resulting in contracts with the operators ending or extension requires, and there were also delays in paying depot owners. And I think the impact we've seen with some of these delays was the fact that some of the depot operators could not utilize a depot because the owner of the land was not paid, and they were then forced to then move some of these tires to another depot so that they can store it. So we then the impact on that sometimes is the fact that you find that one of these depots is now overpiled with these tires, which is also then a risk to the environment and also quality of human health. The main root causes, just to summarize, that we have highlighted specifically around the findings in the pre-terminal objectives was the fact that they really need to look at how they are setting their targets to ensure that their targets are smart, but also to ensure that they establish proper processes to be able to measure these indicators and targets that they are setting up, so that it, they will
be able to ensure consistent collection and correlation of information to be reported. We also then said we need to really look at the control environment, whether it's in the Westbury department, also in the SCM unit and the financial unit, to ensure that they improve the control environment and with some of the things that we are raising. So today I won't go through the rest of the presentation to time, but I think from our side, this is the summary, the message we are then presenting around the EFF. Thank you, sir.
Siyabulela kwakhona ke. All right, colleagues, questions? Going once. Going twice. Thrice. All right, Mazamba.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and colleagues. I'm sorry I was late logging on, various circumstances. Mr. Chairman, the issue of these waste tires has been a nightmare now for a decade. You will probably recall the failure of the first service provider to deal with scrap tires. And it was then they were getting the levy that's charged on the sale of new tires was going directly to this service provider. They had a management company which was making a huge amount of money, but the scrap tires were just weren't being sorted out, and so the budgeting model was changed so that the scrap tire levy now comes into the fiscus, and there's a budget allocation to environmental affairs to deal with scrap tires. But it seems that it's simply not working. My reports from tire dealers is that the agents who are supposed to collect these scrap tires simply do it on an infrequent and ad hoc basis. Scrap tires are building up all over the country with tire merchants who are unable to dispose of these any other way. Particularly not in landfill full sites. So the whole process is a mess. I'm not sure that the AG can give us much help, but is the AG of the opinion that the model is once again failing and that we need to look at more carefully at how this model is constructed, particularly because the levies are pouring into the fiscus and they're not being ring-fenced for this purpose. So we're not sure. We'll have to submit questions to the Minister of Finance as to what the levy revenue is as compared to the allocation for the actual dealing with scrap tires. So does the AG feel that it's just simply bad management and competence of the department, not ensuring that the money is spent properly? I mean, the one instance, the money was paid for a site which couldn't be used. Or is there a need to relook at the model? Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thanks, Mazamba. No, don't apologize for your late login. We were informed that you would shortly after we started, so I did register that. All right, let's get a response to that. Unless there's any other questions, colleagues, we can move on to Land Bank. All right, a response?
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think the model is being failed by having less processors and a lot of depots that are storing tires, and some of the programs that were supposed to ensure that majority of the tires that have been stored at the depots are processed and have ceased to operate. My understanding is that there were two big cement factories that were heavily reliant on the tires that were shredded, that Unfortunately, they invested quite a lot of money in those processes to ensure that they receive shredded tires from the department, but unfortunately that process also failed. And if you look at the ratio of the number of individuals that are responsible for the waste tire versus the responsibilities that they are supposed to uphold in terms of monitoring the processes, you realize that the Waste Bureau didn't have enough project managers to can see the processes that are supposed to happen, you know, on a regular basis. So in a nutshell, there isn't enough sort of process in how many tables that we're going to have versus the processors. And again, my thinking is that a lot of the processors that were there, they have since closed shop. So if there was a way of encouraging the number of processors, then we will be having a proper system of recycling the tires that have been stored at the landfill site. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other matters? I think what we'll need to do, research team, working with the AD team, there's something that was flagged here, and I noted it with concern, but from another perspective, the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Transport had also underspent at some point, I think by about 1.2, 1.7 billion rand. And now there's underspending reported. I think we need to look at that because there's a lot of underspending in a sea of problems. So Tim, can we pull out research team, content advisor, working with the AG team? Let's look at that underspending component. Because for some may say it's good that they didn't overspend, but underspending in itself is a problem because you budget consistent with an ATP. And so if you're falling short of your targets, and the problems, you know, service delivery challenges are all prevailing, that in itself is a finding. It's something to look at. So I think let us look at that, get a full schedule of the underspending, and maybe also work with National Treasury, and then have that circulated to members in about 2 weeks' time, so that they can have sight of it, and then we can then even written submissions for the reasons as to why departments and entities are underspending. All right, thank you very much on that. Land Bank?
Thank you so much, Honorable Chair. Good morning, Honorable Members, and also the colleagues on the call. My name is Nombakamo Matanzima. I am Business Unit Leader that oversees the Land Bank audit. Excuse my voice. I'm actually recovering from the flu. With me today, I've got Nicholas Mukwena, who's the Deputy Business Unit Leader for Land Bank, and also Ziyanda Vichima, who's going to be taking us through the presentation. But before I can hand over to Ziyanda, I just want to highlight to the committee that the Land Bank performance information was not subjected for audit. And the main reason for that is because the Land Bank was granted an exemption, Section 92 exemption by National Treasury, not to table the corporate plan. The reason for that is, if you all remember, that the Land Bank was previously defaulted on its obligations with the lenders, and they are currently resolving what they termed as the liability solution. So that is still in progress, and once has been that debt default cure has been cured, then they will be able to present and also present their corporate plan and be subjected for audit. So we only look at the financial statements and not necessarily on the performance information of the Land Bank. I will hand over now, with your permission, Honorable Chair, to Ziyanda to take the committee through the detailed presentation.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right, Doc?
Good morning to you and the members.
The document was circulated. I will start again with the overall audit outcomes of the land bank. So as you can see on my screen currently, I am presenting the history of the audit outcomes for the land bank for the past 4 years. And you can see that the bank has actually shown improvement in terms of their audit outcomes. Yes, we did not audit the performance in the current year, but in terms of the areas that we noted as material issues in the current year, we looked at those in detail as part of the follow-up in the prior audit, and during the audit as well, and we did not note any material adjustments in the financial statements. Okay, in the last financial audit report that we tabled, the 2021-2022 audit report, Land Bank did receive a clean audit outcome as of the year end. This has been an improvement from a qualification which we issued in the previous financial year. The qualification from the previous financial year was mainly from a limitation of scope where the audit team could not obtain some of the information, key information that was required to audit the gross loan book. In the 2021-2022 financial year, management did engage their SLA partner and reached an agreement that they will provide the audit team with the information that is required for audit. And the team then went to the premises of this SLA partner, and we obtained the information both for the prior year, which we then needed for opening balance testing, and as well as for the 2022 financial year. And after that testing, then we were able to then ensure that this qualification was then resolved. So the overall audit outcome then was a clean audit outcome from Land Bank after then that qualification limitation was resolved. As much as there were no material adjustments, Chair, we note that the going concern still remains an issue with the Land Bank as it relates to the liability solution. But we'll go into detail with the liability solution when we discuss the going concern of the entity. But I would like to provide the committee of other areas that we looked at during the audit. One of the key areas that we looked at is the expected credit losses coming from the loan book, as the land bank then does provide the financial assistance. So they are then required to provide an estimate of expected credit losses. Now, during this audit, we have identified that there were misstatements that were coming from the calculation of the ECL. However, the overall when we looked at the overall ECL figure, these misstatements were not material. We did, however, indicate to management and those charged with governments that they need to look at the root causes of these misstatements, and they must ensure that when they correct these misstatements, they follow proper governance processes, as these were coming through from the ECL model. Yes, the misstatements were not material for the current financial year, but it's something that then we then recommended management that they must look into to ensure that these do not become material in future. We also note then, Chair, that in the last audit cycle, you would note that the Land Bank did report a profit in the 2021-2022 financial year of about 1.3 billion. And of that 1.3 billion, we noted that 800 million is coming from impairment releases. Now, impairment releases, what happens is when they issue the loans, they need to do an estimate of the expected credit losses. But what occurred then in the 2022 financial year is that the sum of their loans
recording in progress.
For the current year. We did, however, analyze their loan book and noted that as much as LandBank was not issuing new loans to the lenders due to the current state of default, they did continue to service some of their customers as it relates to their production loans and working capital loans. But we then do encourage LandBank that their liability solution does get resolved with speedily to ensure that then the bank does focus on its key mandate, where they are then able to provide financial assistance even to lenders, that new lenders, where they might be then looking to enter into the agricultural sector. On the going concern chair, we talked to the liability solution first, which is still underway. We note that when we concluded the audit in the prior year, the liability solution was still not concluded, and at that time, it was set to be finalized by end of September. However, the agreement has not yet been reached with the lenders, and those discussions are still underway. What we then did as part of the audit, we then assessed the bank's going concern, also considering the financial standing of the entity. And what we did note, that we noted that the bank does continue to service its operational costs during the year. And we also then noted that the bank has actually managed to decrease its funding liabilities from 41 billion in 2020, which is the year that they started being in default, to 29 billion at the end of March 2022. And this balance as of December 2022 is now sitting at 23 billion, which then indicates that LandBank does aim to then ensure that this these liabilities are being paid off. What is then key is the conclusion of the liability solution, which will then enable the bank to refocus also then on the provision of its mandate. We also then considered the commitment, even though there was no firm commitment from the lenders not to call upon their debt, but we noted that they continue to engage the bank, and they had received letters from their lawyers that represent them, indicating that they will continue to engage and support in the finalization of the liability solution. What was also then key, Chair, was that the net asset position of the bank still remains positive, and hence then, as much as there are these going concern uncertainties, we did not raise a finding as it relates to going concern, as this was adequately disclosed in the financial statement. In our audit report, we do put an emphasis of matter, where we direct the users of the financial statements to the disclosure that management has made as it relates to the liability solution. On the key focus areas, one of the key focus areas then was the audit of the performance information, and as we noted that the LandBank is exempt in terms of Section 92 of the PFMA, and this exemption does apply until the liability solution has been cured. We have also then confirmed that for the current financial year, the exemption still applies to the bank, and once then the liability solution has been cured, then we will then be able to audit the annual performance report. We also then note this in our audit report as well, to indicate that the performance information has not been subjected to an audit. We know findings, material findings that we've identified on the placing of compliance chair, and what we've done on the compliance area, we've analyzed irregular expenditure, where we've noted that there has been a decrease compared to the prior year, and one of the key contributors was one from the current financial year, where the LandBank had requested an extension of a contract by 3 years, and National Treasury did grant that extension, but it only granted it for 2 years. However, LandBank did continue then to utilize that service provider for a few months after that 2 year period had ended, which then resulted in the irregular expenditure of 7.6 million. What we then also noted, Chair, was which contributed to the decrease in the irregular expenditure was an amount of 19 billion, which was then condoned by the board and national treasury after year end. We spent a lot of time during the audit, Chair, analyzing the consequence management as it relates then to the irregular expenditure of the bank. And our conclusion then was that the entity has done sufficient work to ensure that consequence management, there is progress made in the investigation as it relates to the irregular expenditure, and hence there is no finding as it relates to consequence management on the irregular expenditure. On the drivers of internal controls, there are four key areas that we have highlighted to management as an area where they need to look into in order to improve the financial performance and overall performance of the entities. One that we highlighted was policies and procedures, where we recommended to leadership that they must ensure that those policies and procedures are adequately and timely updated to ensure that the entity and the business processes are followed according to the latest guidance that has been provided by the entity. On the IT governance side and in the IT systems control area, we had recommendations from management as it relates to cyber security, where we had noted that there are key systems that the bank needs to invest on in order then to ensure that cyber security is adequately managed within the entity. And lastly, Chair, then the internal audit capacitation. We noted that an internal audit is another assurance level that is then required in an audit to ensure that the audit outcomes do improve and the risk within the entity is managed. Yes, they have showed improvement in the audit outcomes, but collaboration with internal and external audit is required to ensure that then the management and those charged with governments do receive the value from their assurance providers. We are then working closely with internal audit to ensure that when they are reports that the external audit team can rely on, we can work closely with them and ensure that we have adequately addressed the risk that we have identified within the end. On the key recommendations, I think from a land bank perspective, what we have noted is the importance of the liability solution. We have noted that the improvement in the audit outcome from the land bank has been through the hard work that we've noticed in the entity. We have noted we have been attending their remedial committee meeting with the audit committee, where they discuss how to address audit and findings, how the liability solution is then going to be closed. And we believe that the effort then that the bank has put in resolving these issues, if the liability solution can be resolved, then the bank can now focus on ensuring that the effort that they did in ensuring that they improved the audit outcomes, they focus that on ensuring that they deliver in the mandate. Yes, we note that they are trying to get there from the 2022-2023 financial year, looking at the scheme that the bank has entered into. But from the committee, we believe that if the committee can assist in ensuring that the bank does finalize this liability solution and it can then focus on business as usual of the entity, as this then does take away time and it then limits the extent that land bank can go and provide funding to the lenders that do require in the agricultural economy, to also then ensure that the food security in the country, the risk is then reduced when we have more farmers being participating in the environment. We also recommend as one of the key recommendations to the committee, Chair, is the filling of key vacancies. We note that the CEO CEO position still remains vacant. And from our engagement, this is a very key role in an organization, and looking at how at the work that was done by the previous CEO to get the bank to where it is today with the improved audit outcome, this is one of the roles that are important at the bank, and also then to ensure that the bank does remain in with this audit outcome. It does require adequate capacitation from them so that they then continue, and this is also the key role that will then ensure that the business of the land bank, it attracts businesses, customers are then attracted. So it's one of them, the recommendation that we look at to say if this role can be filled timeously, because we are now nearing end of the year already, and I think it's not a good picture if such a key role remains as a cat for such a long time. Chair, we have also spoken to the recommendation then as it relates to the capacitation of the internal audit team, so that then we can work closely with them. We'll be able to work closely with them once they're then able to deliver timely on the work that they provide. And what is then and our last recommendation is a forecast strategy by the land bank to focus on, once resolving the liquidity challenges, focus on ensuring that the bank that does provide the loans that it needs to provide, and it does provide the financial assistance that is meant to provide. And in that way, then there is no gap in the economy, because the bank is a government institution which is then said to fill a gap in the agricultural sector. So if they're then able to have this refocus strategy that's focusing now on providing the required assistance in the economy, it will then ensure that the land bank not only achieves clean audit outcome, but is then also impactful in the citizens of the country. So thank you, Chen.
Thank you very much. All right. Any comments, colleagues? Mazamba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the AG. Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit perplexed with regard to the whole going concern thing. I just don't understand it. There seems to be a bit of fancy footwork there. Can it be explained again to me, or to us, sorry? In terms of this liability solution, which is spoken about a great deal, 23 billion, 29 billion, whatever the amount is now, and how you get to the conclusion that it is a going concern, given that I think it's had 7 billion rands worth of bailouts in the past few years, and again, last week, another bailout is planned for it. So without the bailouts, presumably it's not a going concern. But what? So I don't understand how the liabilities solution is. I'm just a bit perplexed about this whole going concern. I do need some comfort there, please. And, Mr. Chairman, sometimes I think borrowers are referred to as lenders, so it might be just me not listening properly. I might be old, but I'm not yet Kupila. But most people are fairly loyal to their banks. So I use my own example. I started off with a post office savings account, and then in 1974 I opened an account with Barclays Bank, which was the predecessor to First National Bank, and I remain a client of First National Bank. The point I'm making, Mr. Chairman, is that people don't move banks very easily. Banks, in some cases, have quite a hold over you. Indeed, it's very difficult to leave them. The AG is flagging a very real risk to the land bank's profitability and sustainability if the borrowers who are servicing their loans from the land bank are moving to other banks. Is the AG aware of what the land bank is doing to prevent that from happening by making it attractive for those borrowers not to move to commercial banks, where clearly they're either getting better deals or better service or something? So you're raising quite correctly the movement of borrowers from the land bank to commercial banks. But what is being done to stop that? If you land up with a whole lot of borrowers who can't service their debt, then that's bankruptcy. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's very valid observation, Mazama. Can you get a response to that?
Thank you so much, Honorable. I'll just kickstart the, and then you can fill in the gaps going forward. Thank you so much, Honorable. Yes, in terms of those two questions, one being what is the liability solution, and the second one in terms of what the land bank is doing to prevent the good customers going to other to the commercial banks. If you start with the liability solution, is actually pertaining to in the April 2020, the land bank was supposed to defaulted on its certain payment obligations, and that actually triggered a cross default on the substantially of all the land bank's borrowings. So the bank suspended the payment of the interest as well as the capital across all its facilities. So because of that, and therefore they have all their loans that might be payable in 5 years' time, were now payable on demand. That means all the lenders now have the right to recall all their loans and the bank should pay them. However, to prevent that kind of a situation, the bank is currently in negotiation with the lenders to ensure that that doesn't continue or happen. And hence, they call it, it's more of a, they call it liability solution, but in a plain main terms, it's actually debt restructuring of their debts from different lenders, whether locally as well as internationally, because it's got both local lenders as well as international lenders. So that is the, what the liability solution is all about. And then in terms of the borrowers, they are currently having the new board has been appointed by the minister, and they are currently working on the whole repurposing of the bank in terms of their strategy. I know currently they are sitting, that it has been approved by the board, and it also has been submitted to the Minister of Finance to also approve the whole operating model of the bank, and also introduce the blended finance. So this is a strategy that is still underway, and it's going through the approval process, and the land bank, I think, will be able to talk to the committee about it on how far they, but there is some strategy that is currently in place to ensure that the sustainability of the bank going forward. And then I will just hand over to Zianda and Nicholas to fill in some gaps that I could not address. Thank you.
Yes. No, thank you so much, Jefferson and also thanks, Honorable Liz, for those questions. Yes, I think your concerns are when you look at the good concern, I think it's the area that we have been worried about since the bank has defaulted in 2020. But for us to come to conclusion that the bank is a good concern, we had to interrogate the actions that were taken by management and also even the activities that trend over the years. As much as we are saying it's a good concern, but we do have other risk. And the conclusion that as much as you are saying you can operate as you have been doing over the years, but there is high risk. And we have highlighted the emphasis of matter around activities. I think when it comes to the action taken by the bank to try to manage or stop the new borrowers or the good borrowers from leaving, Lapogam might address them. Yeah, it's really like the repurposing of the bank. But
for you to be able to get good customers, you need to demonstrate that you've got good governance, you've got stable entities, you are actually addressing the issues and you're forcing your mandate. And that's what the bank is currently trying to do, to reinforce the bank and ensure that they are forcing their mandate so they can get their good customers. Thank you, Chairperson.
Alright, is Team AG done?
It's covered, sir.
Okay, I think what we need to do on this land bank issue is that quite a number of these SOEs were cited as going to be receiving cash injections from in the minister's budget speech. And there's a long list of them, SAA, Land Bank, Post Office, and so on. Let's find a date to get a briefing specifically from National Treasury on all the financial interventions, including the takeover of Eskom debt and so on, so that there's a broader clarity on it. So, Babu Somya.
Thank you very much, Chair, and my apologies for connecting a bit late. I reported my predicament. Yes, I've had the AG's team's presentation. Thanks for that. But my problem is similar to what the Honorable Liz has highlighted. It's on the fact that are we not delaying the inevitable? Looking into those listed risks, looking into the quantum of indebtedness of the land bank, looking into the diminishing population of a customer base, and do you really think that in the recent future, are they going to be able to meet the standard fully of venturing into liquidity? I take your point in terms of the solutions which they are working on, and as well on the actual declaration by them in terms of the numbers in their financials, but are you really not deferring the inevitable in this instance? Thanks, Chair.
Somebody still there, you done? All right.
I'm done. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Just that it was glitchy. Okay, AG.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I think the risk is there, Chair. Hence, we do note when we engage management that it's something that they need to look into. And looking at them working through the repurpose strategy, it's something that is also key to them to ensure that they do bring in the business, they do ensure that the entity is going to continue in the foreseeable future. With the plans being there, the risk does still remain. As long as the liability solution still remains unresolved, the risk is still there. As long as the bank hasn't shown improvement in getting more customers, the risk still remains. But the bank does have a strategy in place to respond to the risk, and it's something that we then continue to look into as part of the audit process.
I'm covered, Chair, except for I'm asking that question because if we are not going to tighten up the bank itself gets back to tighten its own screws around those elements. We might really see the bank swimming into the previous standing of a deeper a problem. So that question is asked so that the Office of the Auditor General should have some kind of a stem state of the current situation of the land bank.
Right. Is there a comment on that from AG Nicholas?
Yes, no, thanks, Chairperson, and thanks, Honorable Somoyo. Yes, this matter, Chairperson, is in our radar. We on a regular basis do engage Land Bank. I think that risk, we don't know how much the risk is there, and hence we are close to this process. And what I think will be important is the collaborative efforts by management, the shareholder, and the land to try to manage the situation, take into account strategic importance of the bank when you look at the role that it plays. From our side, we do take a note of your comment on the Somoyo. We will be close to the land bank and we'll make sure that when that risk comes, like we have the first one to let him go.
Right, the matter is on the radar. All right, that's fine. All right, Team AG, thank you. I've covered all the entities, right? Corner side. That's it, right? AG?
Thanks, you've covered everyone.
Yeah. All right. Team AG, thank you very much for that. We will be in touch when the hearings are scheduled to as and when new matters arise. And please note the issues I flagged, and our team will be in touch on those areas. Babum TV, can I hand over to you and the SIU, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Can I also just greet the Honorable members of the SCOPA? Chair, again, we'll just go straight to it. I'm joined by my colleague, Ms. Gina Torres, who will be running through the presentation. She's supported by Mr. Lakhato, the National Chief National Investigation Officer. Dr. Wells is also with us. She's in charge of the civil litigation, because there's quite a number of civil litigation outcomes. We're also joined by Mr. Khanyaho. The various lead investigators into the matters that were presented by the AG were also in attendance, and we'll probably just summarize our sort of observations at the end. Because we've made several observations during the AG presentation. Honorable Chair, without wasting time, I'll hand over to my colleague, Ms. Gina Pretorius. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, sir. Morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I'll get straight into it. Thank you for the opportunity for the SIU to present the progress on our matters. This is a presentation that we did previously to SCOPA, so what we have done is just highlight in red where there have been changes and progress made since we last presented to SCOPA. So the presentation covers briefly the impact of our investigations, a new slide which sums up the savings and cash recoveries that we've made, our reporting milestones, and then the status on all the civil litigation matters. And this is all the matters that are live. The investigations are completed, but the litigation is still alive in a lot of matters, and so we'll report on the progress there. Then just to recap on the criminal and disciplinaries, any changes there. And then I want to give the bulk of the time to the head to touch on the governance report, which is a new aspect that we'll be unpacking for for you today. And then lastly, just the status of the payment of the SIU's invoices. This screen is an overall view of the impacts of the SIU's investigations at the SABC, with a total of the AFU and NPA referrals listed top left corner, 24 disciplinaries against 14 officials, and the details of who has left and been dismissed. Then bottom left, our civil litigation. In total, we have approximately 711 million rand worth of contracts that are in court currently. It is important to note that that's not the total amount that can be recovered, because the court will look at just and equitable when making an order and may only recover profits and not the whole contract value from suppliers. We've had successful judgments in multiple matters in the High Court, and we'll unpack that a little bit later. And then 27 million rands worth of cash recoveries and 150 million rands worth of savings to the SABC in various matters. There's more detail of that in the following slide. And then we have concluded our reporting obligations to the Office of the President in respect of both proclamations, with the last report having been submitted, point number two, on the 6th of December last year. This slide is the overall summary of savings and recoveries in respect of each matter. I will just run through them very briefly. Mr. Mortzening's success fee, where we successfully got an order to recover the fee as well as the interest, and the SIU as well as the attorneys and SABC involved are in the process of getting writs of execution to go and physically get the assets for that cash to be in the bank for SABC. Vision View, 6.3 million rand worth of profits that were recovered for the SABC, and the contract was obviously set aside. Mott MacDonald, a 7 million rand contract set aside in court, and an agreement of 1.2 million rand, which will be paid by Mott MacDonald to the SABC today. So we're monitoring that. Mr. Mortzening's legal fees, which were paid by the SABC, a further successful court order here, where the legal fees had to be repaid from 851,000, as well as interest and costs incurred, which amounted to 1.2 million rand cash back in the bank. Rapid Blue, the matter was settled out of court, and 199,000 was repaid by the supplier to the SABC. Then where we incurred savings is where we assisted the SABC in defending claims in the Asante Fana matter for 350,000. TNA Media, who brought a claim of 144 million against SABC. And then the SABC Legends matter, where the contract was set, the payment was set aside, and the saving of the additional 5.8 million rand, which was due to be paid out, is recorded as a saving. Here we've got a potential recovery of 2.4 million rand. So whereas the court ordered that the payments were irregular, there's a dispute over whether we can recover the 2.4 million due to prescription. That's why it's marked in italics there and doesn't make up a part of the total savings, because the SIU's taking that matter on review. So that leaves us with 150 million rands worth of savings that have been incurred and 27 million rands worth of recoveries, which excludes that 2.4 million, the last item. And the only change on our reporting milestones, as I mentioned earlier, was the final presidential report on the first big proclamation, which went to the presidency in December of 2022. So all reporting obligations are concluded there. Then on the civil litigation, as I said, we have just highlighted in red where we have had changes. There is an overlap between matters and numbered in the left column, number 1, 2, and 3, all involving Mr. Mortzening, the success fee, as well as the damages claim that was brought regarding his irregular appointment of staff, as well as terminations, etc. So in respect of this matter, we have successfully received the court order which sets aside the success fee of 1.5 million rand, and it needs to be paid back with interest. And as I said earlier, those writs are in the process of being issued and executed in order to recover those assets. And then the taxation is also has been set down for 27th, which was yesterday, and we're monitoring progress in that matter. The matter against Mr. Maguva and others was brought alongside the matter in respect of Mr. Mortzening. So if we couldn't recover in the one, we have this one as a backup option. And this is also proceeding in court. And as is stated on the right-hand side there, that this matter will proceed if we are unable to recover everything from Mr. Morton Nang in respect of the claim against him. Again, the slide here relates to the first three. They are all interconnected. And if there are any detailed questions around these, the lawyers are on the call. Safe to say that we have engaged with SABC, and the column on the right does speak to the viability of civil litigation. We'll be carefully monitoring to see that we are not litigating in vain on any matters, and where some matters are being held back pending the outcome of other matters. So that has been carefully considered in order to save costs on legal fees for the SABC. Moving on, the Sakela Kubiso matter, the update here that we can report to Parliament is that we got a judgment in December, and there has been a settlement agreement reached between the parties, and $6.1 million was paid to Sakela, and that is in full and final settlement of the case that the SIU and SABC brought. Vision View, this contract was set aside, and $6.3 million rand has been paid to the SABC, and this is recorded as a cash recovery by the SIU. Lorna Vision and Mr. James Aguma matter. Here we applied for a default judgment, and the application was heard in June of 2022. Judgment was reserved. We have followed up with the judge regarding when we may expect judgment. The matter is also trial ready, and there's various notices in that are being filed. We are in the process of trying to trace Mr. Aguma, as he has changed residential addresses, and we're busy tracking him down. Safe to say that the main matter will be enrolled for hearing once we've received a judgment in the default judgment application against Lorna Vision, as these matters are connected. I did mention that earlier. In respect of Mr. Moodley and others, this matter also relates to Lorna Vision, and here the SIU was proactive in seeking to pierce the corporate veil and hold the directors of Lorna Vision personally liable for losses suffered by the SABC as a result of the unlawful contract which was concluded between SABC and Lorna Vision. The heads of argument on the exception are ready to be filed once we get the judgment in the Lorna Vision matter. But if we aren't successful in getting assets back from Lorna Vision, the company, then this is the backup for us to go against the directors and to pierce the corporate veil. Bessie Tiguana, this matter is also related to the Vision View contract. We can report that the application to compel Mr. Guana to sign the billet was heard in February of 2023, and the order was granted with costs. She has since delivered her signed pre-trial minute, which allows the matter to progress, and we've now applied for a trial date in this matter. The Geconomics matter, which traded as Infonomics when they contracted with the SABC. The application to compel was set down in June of 2022, and judgment was granted in the favour of the SIU and SABC with costs. The main review application was heard in August of 2022, and the judgment has been reserved, and we await the same. In respect of Ms. Rafaela, an irregular expenditure that she was involved in to the tune of 20 million rand. I just want to note here that we have frozen the pension benefits so that we can ensure recovery. And in relation to the actual civil case, the pleadings have closed and the trial has been enrolled for hearing on the 13th of May, 2024. The Mott MacDonald matter here, the experts were co-opted to assist with coming to an agreement on what amount should be paid back to the SABC by Mott MacDonald. There was a bit of a standoff, but since a settlement agreement has been reached, and Mott MacDonald will pay the $1.25 million to the SABC, and that is due today. The NPA referrals made by the SIU in respect of Phase 1, there were a total of 29 referrals to the NPA. The one matter that is proceeding in court and which the SIU has been monitoring at every court appearance, the trial has proceeded against Ms. Moswene, and we have been in attendance. The trial was most recently in court and postponed to the 14th of April 2023, and that is for the trial to continue. At this point, it is still at the state's case. There were also various NPA referrals made in respect of a success fee that Mr. Motseneng received, and these involved three former SABC officials and two former board members, and these were sent to the NPA in June of 2020. Disciplinaries to date, again, this is just recapping what was previously the outcomes of these matters have already been presented to FERPA, and you do have the presentation, so I won't waste time on going into the details here. I'd rather get to the civil litigation so that we can report back on status there. As I said, these are live matters. Civil matter number 13, the SIU and SABC took on the Mjayeli security contract. And in respect of this matter, the review application was heard on the 9th to the 11th of May 2022, and the judgment was reserved. We have followed up, and we've been informed that the judgment will be provided to us in due course, so we await an outcome on that matter. TNA Media, this matter I reported earlier, we've got 144 Rand savings where a claim was not progressed against the SABC that was brought by TNA. And then following recommendations made in the State Capture Commission of Inquiry report, the SIU has already joined the SABC in bringing an application against TNA and its directors to recover the costs that were incurred by the SABC for the TNA broadcasts. Our application was heard on the 7th of February of this year and was successful, and we served an application to join the former directors of TNA to the proceedings, and we await any opposition should they choose to oppose the application that we have brought. The SABC Legends payment, in respect of this matter, we got a judgment in October of 2022 in which the decision to approve the payments was reviewed and set aside. So this would have resulted in the repayment of 2.4 million rand, which was paid out to the Legends, and a saving of 5.8 million rand, because that was still due to be paid based on the decision that had now been set aside. However, the judge ruled that the amount paid, the 2.4 million, cannot be reclaimed from the respondents as the claim had prescribed. The SIU has appealed, and our notice of appeal has been filed, and the appeal record was served on the 8th of February 2023, and we await receipt of the answering affidavits. So the 2.4 million could still be recovered if our appeal is successful, and the importance of this appeal lies most importantly in respect of the crucial issue of prescription. The Rayback properties and the lease of the SABC offices in Nelspruit. This matter was heard in court in October of 2022 and the judgment has been reserved. The review application by Mr. Mortzening against Public Protector and others. This matter was also heard in May of 2022 and the judgment was handed down in August of 2022. Mortzening's application was dismissed with costs. We have briefed our costs consultant to prepare the bill of costs, so that was a successful outcome there as well. The regular payment of Mortzening's legal fees, as I mentioned earlier, Mr. Mortzening is in the process of paying off the total sum of 1.2 million, which is the capital plus interest plus costs, in monthly installments. We are tracking that repayment, and a total of 49,000 is the balance that is now owing on that total amount. Then the only movement here on the Phase 2 disciplinary that were referred is in respect of the first matter, where we were informed that the SABC has elected not to proceed with a disciplinary action. The SIU is engaging with the SABC to determine the reasons for this decision and will evaluate it going forward. Then the last slide that I'll be presenting on before I hand over to the head is the targeted awareness campaign. In February of 2020, the SIU approached the SABC with an initiative based on our revised operating model and new value chain. And this is where the SIU identified a need to render prevention and advisory services to our affected state institutions that we conduct investigations at. This initiative is aimed at assisting these state institutions to prevent a recurrence of the serious maladministration that prompted an SIU investigation. So we're there to assist them based on the learnings of our work there. The initiative will create awareness amongst targeted groups of people and focus areas that have been identified by the SIU through the learnings in our investigation, so that we can proactively influence the systemic and behavioral root causes of maladministration, fraud, and corruption. The campaign is a value add and does not form part of the proclaimed investigation. The SIU bears the cost of organizing this campaign, but is amenable to contributions to assist in facilitating it. Unfortunately, the SABC did not take up this initiative, but we will will again engage with the new board as to options available to them in respect of this. I'll hand back here to the head of the unit to continue with the governance review that was conducted at the SCFPC. Over to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Pretorius. Honourable Chair and honourable members, I will proceed from here. While we are on the awareness campaign, the previous slide, the rationale behind that awareness campaign is really to ensure that we close the loop in terms of root cause analysis and ensuring that the corporation put in place measures to avoid the maladministration, corruption, and malpractice that we have uncovered. We really expect that as we re-engage with management and the board, that we should be able to proceed with this process. So that's, as my colleague says, that's more around prevention. Now the next slide deals with the we call it governance review, but in the main, this focuses on what the proclamation authorizes to investigate, which is maladministration and malpractices. It's called like that in the legislation, but in a sense, it's really to ensure that we review the governance process as a whole, if appropriate. So you will see our comments on the last paragraph, which is really our view, is that we completed this review and we submitted to the former chairperson and then the board. So what we really need to do further is to re-engage whenever the board is appointed and re-engage with management. And I'll come back to the next steps at the end of the presentation. The next slide gives an overview. If you can just show the whole picture, please, in the interest of time. It really shows what our view is. We got the experts really to enhance our team here, experts in corporate governance to assist the team and enhance the team in investigating. This is an overview of what we refer to as breakdown in ethical governance. You'll see immediately on the left-hand side, at the top is oversight and monitoring. There are various provisions where we expect the corporation to be monitored and the oversight role of the board committees, including, of course, the audit committee, supported by the company's secretary. There's various findings and observations that we have made in the overall report. So we also looked at the issues relating to culture, because that can really have an impact on the ethics of the organization. And part of the high-level views is that the culture is characterized by fear and not really getting things done. And we say there are consequence management, but it's actually lack of consequence management. We also looked at the skill set that would be required around the board and other positions in the corporation. We also looked at the behavioral aspects that would really go towards ensuring that the corporation really complies. We looked at the role of the executive authority with regard to the political guidance and influence. We have also found that there was a willful disregard for controls and policies and a measure of abuse of power. With regard to policies, and we'll show on the next slide, we found that there was a number of policies that were outdated and some not embedded and implemented. Now, this is the slide that follows on the previous one, obviously. Just high level, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members,
is that we found quite a measure of outdated policies, policies that were requested and not received, and these would be policies that would have an impact on the processes of the cooperation. We found ineffective internal controls or governance protocols. We also found some high-risk functions that were really not overly provided for, and the issue around overlapping of policies, ensuring that those overlaps are appropriately managed, and so on. So if you go to the next slide really just determines quite an intense work that was done around the policies themselves now. This, of course, relates to behavioral aspects, particularly with regard to willful disregard of all of this. Without going through them in detail, Honorable Chair, we have found, and the numbers that we show there is sort of some of the instances that we indicate, but there were issues around dishonesty, issues around deviations from scope, failure to follow prescripts of national treasury instructions, unauthorized expenditure, manipulation of policy, and so on. So without going through line by line. Now, this slide is again addressed quite in detail in the final report of this work. This slide really indicates incidents of non-compliance and breaches of policies, laws, and delegations of authority framework. And this is really a picture which says if the corporation looks at this, and as I would comment at the end, that if it includes this in the corporate improvement plan, which will be monitored, we are definitely going to see an improvement and a real compliance environment. This slide also deals with the, as you can see, a percentage of investigations and the breakdown of the types of irregular incidents that occurred. So, Honorable Chair, you know, just engaging with my team, that in the interest of time, we had to really give this picture to the Honorable Committee. But if need be, of course, there will probably be a need so that we go into detail on all of this, and the audit, the Honorable Committee can, you know, invite us to do that, and we will do that in parallel as we engage the SABC management. If you just slide on, please. Right. Part of the focus was really to look at the monitoring and the oversight requirements at SABC. Now, so we actually saying the monitoring should not only reside in internal SAB structures, and we will be, you know, in interacting with the shareholder department, DPE, so that measures are put in place. And we have noted what the AG has indicated around the SOE bill, or they call it Shareholder Act. But we are aware that there's a SOE bill that's been considered, and this from the DPE should really ensure that going forward there is a focused oversight and monitoring from DPE over and above the internal monitoring by the board and by the board committees, by the executive, and ensuring that all of what we have uncovered is really monitored for not to be repeated. 1, 2, and 3 there at the bottom is really some of the views we are expressing, is that SIU report to be sent to the Auditor General. We're doing that, of course, as part of the MOU that we have with the Auditor General, that we have seen that is very useful, so that they can look at that as they prepare their audit plans.
part of the views that we're expressing is around the function of internal audit. And this is probably not only at SABC, it's probably a concept that we could explore with DPE and, of course, the AGSA as well, in terms of the reporting of the internal audit of the state institutions. This is SOEs, departments, and so on, but here in particular SABC. But this would probably be, you know, something that has to be looked at around the risk management function. So we also indicated the issue around forensic practitioners to internal audit, because really ensuring that probity audits are done in the high-risk areas. The next slide, please. The next slide really just goes about what we always do in terms of our observations. We're saying existing policies and procedures at SABC, our investigation showed that they were bypassed by the board and senior managers, which led to financial woes of the corporation. And we are seeing those outcomes and consequence management where all of this non-compliance pointed to individual officials. There was a general abuse of power at the SABC by the board and senior managers. We have seen some of the outcomes relating specifically to some of the senior managers, and in particular the former COO and CEO, who has taken us up to the Supreme Court of Appeal and has failed. So we are glad to see that outcome, and hopefully a clear message is sent out to the public and those who would be, you know, people who would not comply with governance processes. Now, we're saying controls were repetitively bypassed through management override, collusion and abuse of power between those in power, or inaction and passiveness from other officials. The limitations of segregation of duties is an internal control measure and reinforces the importance of maintaining a culture of awareness and enablement of officials to act when non-compliance occurs. Without an ethical culture, the efficacy of internal control measure is compromised. So that's our view. Next slide. Now, obviously, this should apply to every state institution. The return to culture that encourages honest discussions around ethics and ethical challenges with one another and their managers, and obviously generally to ensure ethical behavior. Employees should be empowered by explaining what constitutes unethical behavior and what the result of such can be on their cooperation. And as a result, this awareness program that we have planned with SABC would go a long way in empowering the employees. We're saying the employees should also know what their rights are and be encouraged to report such before it becomes a widespread problem. Of course, we also ensure that the issue of whistleblowers protection is also receives attention, because we've seen from this space in SABC, we've even seen a group of officials who really constituted themselves and advocated around the rights of whistleblowers. We are ensuring, as we work with the Department of Justice, that is spearheading the changes in this space to ensure that that is done. Employees should be held accountable and responsible for the behaviors and decisions. We'd like to see that at all levels. And changes should come from the management team by identifying the negative behaviors and substitute them for positive changes. That's probably an obvious statement that we would like to see as a result. And we're saying this will allow for better ethical decisions, enforcement of policies and procedures amongst employees, and role model ethical behavior. Next slide, please. Right, this is the last slide. We're saying this is just amongst others. Management should allow the correct procedures in the appointment and promotions of employees, and said appointment should be approved by delegated authority. There's quite a number of processes in the recruitment space, including some of the integrity checks, vetting processes, and so on. So this is probably just a statement, but there's a whole lot of processes in there, as the honorable members would know. It should be realized by those charged with governance when implementing the recommendations contained in this report that the efficacy of governance structures is not determined by the existence of the structure itself, but by how it operates and responds to ethical and governance dilemmas. Policies should be updated to prevent the risk from governance and audit perspective. We found quite a number of policies that were not updated. And the update of policies, as the honorable members would be aware, takes into account any changes in the business environment, in the legal environment, to ensure that the policies are updated so that they are relevant. Now, maintaining an ethical culture, this is really quite a repeat reference to ethical behavior, is an inherent obligation of all employees. Ethical responses to instances of non-compliance should be included in key performance indicators for all employees at all levels, including, I would say, at the board level, with the necessary weight attached when you do the performance appraisals. Right. Just in closing there, the zero tolerance stance to abuse and non-compliance with internal controls should be prioritized, as this would address the culture of abuse and management override. So, Chair, this is the last slide, and my colleague will come back to the fees. Before she goes on to this fees, I really want to make this comment that what you have seen is that we are doing an evaluation of an investigation against the proclamation, so that we close the loop to ensure that we've delivered as expected by the proclamation. We've covered all the areas, and we will do this with management at SABC. The issue around consequence management, we would like to continue to monitor that all those that have been pointed to are held to account relating to civil recoveries, disciplinary actions, NPA referrals, and all others. What we have really focused at length today, as the last part of those slides, was the issue around maladministration, malpractice, which of course included issues around governance failures. We have seen this in various of the state institutions where we have investigated, that it is very important to close our investigations in this way, dive deep into the maladministration and malpractice and governance failures. This would help the state institutions themselves, the shareholders, and of course it will also help the Honorable Committee in terms of continued monitoring of the improvement. Now, the expectation is that we expect the SABC board, the SABC, the accounting authority, we expect the SABC management to include all of this into what could be called a corporate improvement plan. We really would like to see that in place. And that should have timelines, responsibilities, controls to be improved, and monitor it going forward. This will, of course, ensure that there's prevention measures, and of course, the issue of monitoring and evaluation becomes very critical on an ongoing basis. So, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, while the pure formal investigation is done, as my colleague indicated, the outcomes are still monitored, civil litigation process ongoing. We'd like to ensure that the disciplinary processes are implemented appropriately. And now we're really going to spend time in our other business aspect. Our business value chain includes these aspects of prevention to interact with the corporation to ensure that there's prevention measures that are put in place. Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I would like to pause here and allow my colleague just to close off on the status of the fees. Ms. Pretorius, over to you.
Thank you, sir. So this slide just gives an overview of where we are in respect of the SABC's payment of the SIU invoices, and it relates to three proclamations. The first line item R19, which are the ones we've reported on today. And there's an amount of 2.8 million that is outstanding. Those are still to be paid by the SABC, and that relates mostly to the legal fees. In respect to the legal fees, it is just a note, as put up at the top of the slide there, that in a lot of the matters, the legal fees that have been incurred were through the SABC and the SIU both instructing the attorneys and using the same attorneys and counsel in order to save costs. And so these invoices have come through the SIU, but cover the costs of both the SABC's legal team and the SIU's legal team as well, but they were shared in order to keep costs low. So we want to thank the SABC for the recent payments that have been made, which has brought down the total outstanding amount quite significantly, and it now just sits at 2.8 million that is owing to the SIU by the SABC. And that concludes our presentation. Thank you very much, Advocate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, as the committee knows that we employ a fee-for-service model, but we really hope that we are able to demonstrate value for money to the corporation, to the state institutions, and of course to the honourable committee members. That if you compare with the monies that have been recovered, and possibly generally the impact of the investigation, because some outcomes would not really be measured in money form, is the impact thereof, consequence management, and some of the regulatory improvement. Honourable Chair, if you allow, just in few words, we have, as I said, we've observed and listened, and thanks for allowing us to. In fact, in all the state institutions that the Auditor General presented, Alexco, DINEL, SASA, DFFE, and except Land Bank, we are all investigating in those institutions. So we will engage with the AGSA so that, you know, we really show the synergy, because as we all work in that space with a respective mandate, we need to be able to come to the committee and say, you know, this really creates an impact such that, you know, this multiple approach of SIU, AGSA, and the others to really ensure that our work has that necessary impact, and we are able to prevent all of this from happening, with the exception that, you know, when National Treasury allows, of course, legally to exempt corporates from presenting corporate plans, it's really something that we have noticed. But, you know, there's some inefficiencies that we have noticed, and the committee would probably have heard that, particularly in SASA. There was quite a mention of referrals to National Treasury, investigations were conducted, but again, it goes back. SASA is advised to appoint a legal firm. A legal firm does its work so that it can advise. So we've seen that kind of a situation. So we will be engaging with the SASA management, just so that we can show them that had they referred to the SIU, they wouldn't have seen this to and fro. That is costly. Being advised to get a legal opinion whether to take action, you know, SIU would immediately have made that finding and then made the recommendation. That's really quite telling. Thanks, Honourable Chair. But as I said, we'll engage with the AG and the state institution concerned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, HOU. I think that last note is important insofar as cooperation is concerned. So I think that is well taken. Colleagues, questions?
once, going twice. All right, Mazamba.
Can't get away with not answering at least one question. it's not even a question. It's just a comment. Gina kind of referred to the legal fees being shared in order to keep them low. I'm glad Gina thinks 23 million rand is low. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think this helps us for tomorrow, colleagues, in our meeting with the SABC. All right. Is there anything else, colleagues, you want to raise? Okay. Let me take this opportunity to thank the SIU and to thank the AG team for all the presentations. And I think it's fundamentally clear from whatever vantage point you stand, that SOEs are in trouble. And I think that should be cause for concern, because you would have thought by now we have moved in a great or significant stride in the improvement, but it has not happened. So we will continue to have these engagements, and I would like to thank the AG team for enlightening us and for briefing us as thoroughly as they have. And Advocate Mtibi and your team, as always, thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure. Colleagues, we'll meet tomorrow for the SABC. And then Sistombi will circulate any further announcements and so on. It's a physical meeting tomorrow. So on that note, in the absence of any other business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you to all of you.
Of course.